My name is Ed Senney, and I teach world religions courses mostly at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. And this week I have been doing a few introductions to some of the neighbors that we have of other faiths, our neighbors in this little bitty world who have faiths other than the Christian faith. I talked about Islam one day, and yesterday I did a little session on Baha'i religion. Today I want to talk a little bit about Hinduism. Tomorrow I want to deal with the question, when Christian meets non-Christian, what? When Christianity meets non-Christian religions, what? What kind of thoughts? What kind of judgments? What kinds of relationship? How inclusive or exclusive is Christianity? And things of that sort. So I want to bring that encounter together tomorrow. Just one more opening clue about my approach to this topic. I always try to take an approach that appreciates whatever can possibly be appreciated in the other religion. When I talk to someone who knows the other religion very, very well, and if I know enough about it to do that with them, then I might be willing to get kind of critical about what I would like to say about that. But until we really understand the faiths of other people, it seems appropriate to me to withhold judgment. And so what I have decided is that what Luther's explanation to the Eighth Commandment, which tells us not to bear false witness against our neighbor, and in his explanation of that commandment, he says we are to put the very best construction on everything. That's what I try to do with other religions, because I have heard so much in the name of Christianity brushing aside, depreciating other religions with no apparent awareness of what they really meant to those people. So I'd like to try to persuade you that there are understandable things here, and there are things worthy of respect, and that doesn't mean we become Hindus today, or that I am a Hindu, but it does mean that I can understand where they're coming from, and I can appreciate that. So I'd like to do something to help you in that direction toward Hinduism today. I've started my little outline here without even approaching Hinduism. I wanted to get a couple words in the vocabulary, because I think they help us to get a feel for how very different Hinduism is compared to something like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the three religions of Abraham. Those are the three children of Abraham. Because in those religions, the Abrahamic religions, we have met this one God and very transcendent. And that's what I want to kind of work on here at first. Immanence in primitive and ancient Near Eastern religions. That word immanence simply means that it refers to the divine being found within, remaining within the stuff of creation. And so we find that Native American peoples, African tribal peoples, ancient Near Eastern peoples, Australian tribal peoples, and just about anywhere we look in the world, we have seen that the religious response is a response to the, I'll use a neutral word, to the sacred in the stuff of nature, usually in the life processes. Where our life comes to us, there is the miracle of the sacred. So it's next, I'll have to save my examples about American Indians for next week mostly, but where we get our food supply, you'll always see a deity of some kind emerging. Wherever the most important sources of our cultural life and our physiological life come to us, there is a God. There is a spirit. There is the sacred in some form or another to be wondered at, to be worshipped. The thing that has impressed me is that people of such tribal societies simply refuse to take for granted that there is life, and that life keeps flowing from the plants, from the animals, to us. And our life comes from some. We are that life which we take into ourselves. That's just a physiological example of life. The life that we eat. And they will not take that buffalo without understanding that it is sacred. Because somehow, if there's the gift of life, there is the giver behind it, somehow in that. And so it is no surprise then that wherever the life comes to them, a named deity usually emerges. And wherever other important things come to them, like maybe even death, or the cultural things that are important in the cultural life. Well, you know, in the example of the buffalo again, the hides are protection from the weather. They are the covers for their dwellings. They are their clothing, and the bones are their tools. And the insides are worked out to become bags to carry things in. And everything in the animal is part of the cultural life. And so is it any wonder that that which gives us our biological and cultural life is a gift from someone, the giver behind it. Now, I'm suggesting that this view of immanence is the clue to polytheism, as we have traditionally called it, polytheism, where the gods are many and they are located in various aspects of nature. And so the cosmic rhythms, those deities that bring the seasons around to us and thus bring us our life comes through the proper rotation of the seasons, those deities that bring us in turn the sunshine and the rain, all of those things that we see as the cosmic rhythms, those are the activities of the divine bringing us the gift of life. And they call for us to worship. And the way of worship is that we, in ritual ways, participate with the gods and spirits in their work. And so we do with them what they are doing. And I won't go into detail about that. But ritual participation in nature. In that sort of understanding of religion, recognizing the sacred as many and in such rhythms, time as history, time that is as something that goes like that, wherever, just isn't too important. Just isn't real important, because what's important is this. Seasons move around, the life cycles come around, and whether you're talking about the life cycle of 4 years, or the life cycle of 60 years, or the life cycle of just 1 year, or in those parts of the world where there are two planting seasons, the cycles of time, not the long-term movement of time where you have historical events unrepeatable, but the constant repetition of spring. The new life, the new year, summer, fall, winter, and all the things that got connected with that. So we find that in religions that where this experience of the sacred, the experience that is in the stuff of life, we find that where we have this, we tend to have less interest in historical events as being revelation, and more interest in the rhythms of nature itself as revealing something. What do they reveal? the divine gift of law,
calling forth our worship.
Then we came to the Hebrew tradition, and it's one must be careful not to make too strong a statement about this, but it does seem as they came into the Mesopotamian culture that was permeating that whole part of the world, ancient Near Eastern world, they took a kind of protest posture against this rhythm of the seasons as the source of revelation, and against this business of gods in the fertility processes of nature. And they posited the notion that the supreme God creator is more transcendent than that. That is, he is always something other than anything he creates. He is separate from it, as the pot is separate from the pot maker. His wisdom is in it, his love has touched it and shows and all that, but you can't worship the pot. Shouldn't, anyway, said the Hebrew prophets, but only the potter. And so they took isn't that beautiful? So they suggested that the sacred could not be, should not be found in these fertility cycles of nature and the Baal worship and the ritual participation in the union of the god and the goddess and all of that. God was not to be found in that. But God has revealed himself in the timeline, in the movement of human history, in a linear way like this. He has done it by once and for all creating the world, starting it all, and then calling his people from Egypt and that Exodus event in which he creates them a people, giving them the land, taking them this way, protecting them this way. And then, of course, as Christians pick it up in this timeline, Jesus Christ comes into that time. And these are historical events. In a certain sense, they are unrepeatable. They don't come around all the time like spring does. And the Hebrews said, this is how we know God. Through these events and their meanings. And so we know him to be a redeeming God and so forth. And he is not to be found within nature. So he transcends it. Creator and creation, he is transcendent. Monotheism in that. Therefore, if he is not in the stuff, then there is only the one that is creator. And it reveals to us his will, that single God, his will and purpose for humanity, they say. And that's the tradition that Christians have inherited from those Hebrew scriptures which made emphases like this. And the prophets would rant and rail against those idol worshipers of the Near East whose basic insight was built upon this notion of radical immanence. They preach the message of radical transcendence. And yet, I had to throw this on there, and yet that same God played that trick on us and entered into our flesh, says the Christian tradition. In a very real way, God in this world and in the flesh. But then Christians usually have not been willing to go from that to say, a bit of himself he put in the flower. Only a bit of his artistry we see in the flower, says, I think, the dominant Christian tradition. But we do not meet him in the flower, in the sun, in any of these aspects of nature. Now, I think understanding that contrast in a radical way, and then realizing perhaps that it isn't always that clear, it's not always that radical. We'll see in Hinduism where they want to talk immanence, but also transcendence. And I believe that there is good warrant within the Christian tradition and within the biblical tradition to soften that radical transcendence a bit and to pick up on some of what I think are religious advantages understanding of the world and appreciation of it by picking up a little on this immanence. So that's kind of an introduction to what Hinduism then will be. Because when we now move from a religion like Islam or Baha'i to look at Hinduism in India here, we all of a sudden run into gods everywhere. All over the place, gods. And of course, as the time has gone on, each of them has its own extensive mythology. The stories and deeds of this deity and that deity are spun out endlessly for so many of what I call these 330 million gods. Not that anyone really counted them.
Save the
fly from frying. Not that anyone ever counted them, but if the divine is radically immanent, then it really is in all forms of life. And so the 330 million is by all means an understatement of the real issue. Nevertheless, we come into Hinduism and we see these many, many deities. I could back up to the earliest period of our studies of Hinduism when the Aryan people first came into India about 1500 BCE. And there I could talk about a form of polytheism which was just that, I think. Many gods, many goddesses, independently worshipped, oftentimes worshipping many of them as though the universe and its operation were compartmentalized. This one does that, that one does this, this one does that. You better kind of touch all the bases to keep things rolling right. And I think we kind of had that at the very beginning of the Indo-Aryan invasion into the Indus Valley region of India. But not very long after that, a mere 500 years after that, somewhere around 1000 BC, we have a new way of thinking that begins to spin out from the thinker priests of the time. And it seems to be an idea that there's something wrong with this compartmentalizing of the whole thing. This god does this, this one does this. And so they began to ask the question, are the many gods really many? Or do they just seem to be the many? And could it be that the many gods are really only different aspects or different manifestations of the one sacred reality? And their answer for that, of course, is obvious in the rhetoric. They say it is the one manifesting itself in these many faces, in these many names, in these many functions, in these many ways of experiencing. So, the one and the many. They tell a story about how it all came to be, that the one became the many. And I will do it my way and thus shorten it real nicely. In the beginning, or for before the beginning, infinitely behind us, there was only the one. And the one was the all. And the one was, they say, Purusha, which means person. The one was person. And in that beginning, all of a sudden we get an illogical problem here. The gods and the sages sacrificed the one, Purusha. Never mind that there weren't any gods and goddesses. There was nothing. There was only the one. But to have a story, you have to have actors. And so bring them in. And the myth will do its job without conforming to your logic. So the gods and the sages sacrificed Purusha, and his parts became this world, and his head became the sky, and his feet became this earth, and his navel became this mid-region, the atmospheric region. And his backbone became the hills and the mountains, and his breath became the wind god and another god or so. And his mouth became the Brahmin caste, the caste of priests, philosophers. And his arms became the Kshatriya caste, the fighters, the rulers of the society. And his thighs became the workers of society, that is, the managers of society. And his feet became the Shudra, the menial workers of society. So the caste system is out of his very body. So this whole physical universe and its social structure are in fact an emanation out of, they are, out of the body of the one deity, sacrifice. So the image of sacrificing the one so that it becomes the all is the image the poets used to try to express how the many gets permeated, why it is permeated with the divine. And so they say something like, this one pervades everything, and yet this world is only like his three fingers, for he is also far beyond it as well. And that later on leads to this notion, see, what that says, I better pause on that one a little, that's kind of big. It says he is in all this stuff, and yet if you add up all this stuff, it's not him. It's not, for he is far more than all that. And it tries to express what we have called immanence and transcendence at the same time. You never have a simple pantheism so that sort of the sum total of all these things is God. But God is always more than all that, yet he pervades everything that is his creation. That's the direction they wanted to go with this hymn, this Purusha hymn. So I find that when, even in modern Hinduism, when we find these many, many, many deities and all the separate stories about them, that behind it all still is this notion that it is one. It is one. You ask the simple person of the village, why do you worship here Krishna? And in the next village I find that your relatives or some friends over there worship Rama. Why? Is one better than the other? Is one different from the other? One Bhagavan. One beloved one. One that's worthy of worship. And they don't explain it. I mean, the simple people don't have to try to explain that to curiosity seekers. They just know somehow that the many are really expressive of the one divine reality. What is more, in Hinduism's view of the divine reality, you have them talking back and forth in almost confusing way about whether the sacred is a he or she, or whether it is it. The divine reality, we'll name it, one of the favorite names that comes up somewhere, I'll put it here since I don't see it. Brahman. Brahman, it pervades all things. As though the divine were a kind of essence that you better not try to control by giving it qualities. Personal qualities are qualities and qualifications in that sense. And so in India we begin to get the sense that they feel that whenever we speak of the sacred as a personal being, father, or even the mother, or anytime it's personal, that we have placed a limitation. That may be okay, as long as you remember that it's just a device. We need devices like that because we are so finite. And so we need devices like making the gods like us, having personality. So some aspects of Hinduism emphasize very strongly that the sacred, whom they will call Brahman, is beyond personhood, transpersonal, But other parts of it, of Hinduism, will unashamedly go ahead and assign the goddess very personal qualities and the god very personal qualities, and and so forth. So there's no consistency about that, but you probably would do well to see both possibilities. God is always more than anything that we can say about him. And to say even him, to say even her, is already to limit. And so they feel better about it in their philosophical reaches of Hinduism if they go to a word like it. Alright. Maybe a little distinction there. You can see that the philosophers would really rather go for a transpersonal, something beyond personhood. And so they sit in meditation to meet that which is unnameable and is the source of all and the end of all. And if they talk about it, they'll talk about it as carefully as they can, beyond personality. And meditation becomes their primary way. Whereas those who worship God in ceremonies and images and so forth are just loaded with personal relationship language. The love of the deity, the serving of the deity's love and care for us and helping us. It's a very personal relationship. So you have those two different kinds of things, and it's all still Hinduism. So you see how broad Hinduism is getting? It's full of transcendence and immanence and personal and non-personal, all in its view of the sacred reality. But human beings are the ones that are religious, so let's see what they think about themselves. A human being is actually the divine manifesting itself in taking a physical form. Now there's a little catch there, and you might see the problem right away. This word Atman is, let's just call it, it is the Brahman, the divine one, as that divine one is present within this person. Each of us has that Atman within us. We might call it the soul. The soul which is in its essence the divine. It is the same as the universal one. Now that is one expression of that universal one, isn't it? It's a spiritual expression of it. The soul within is invisible, even as this deity is invisible. And yet we said that this ultimate one has become the world, the dirt, the plants, the flowers. Everything is the imminent manifestation of that divine. So my body, to talk to the question of what is a person, my body is an expression of Brahman, or the single divine one, in two ways. In a manifest way, that which can be touched by the senses, this body, and that part of it's temporal. That part of it goes away. And the other expression of the deity that is me, and that does not go away, is the Atman, the eternal soul. So they don't want to say that this body, which passes through to the dust and then takes on new forms of life and feeds new forms of life, they don't want to say that isn't the divine, but it is the divine in its manifest form rather than its unmanifest form. And the Atman is the unmanifest form. Now, they believe that that unmanifest form of the deity comes repeatedly into this flesh. And so we have the cycle of reincarnation back into the carnage, into the flesh, over and over and over. I have to draw circles when I do this. Born, the Atman is born, and we have this little old 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 year old lifetime. And it dies, there is death. There is perhaps some kind of interim time here that the soul is in another region or something like this, and there have been thousands of different theories about that. But ultimately, that Atman must come back into birth again. And round it goes again. So reincarnation, it's the way that the whole cosmos works. The seasons are cyclical. In fact, they say that the worlds themselves, the universes, come into being, have their lifespan, eons and eons maybe, but eventually they perish. They go out of being, or another way to say it is they are absorbed back into the one. And then they come into being again, and they have this rhythm of the world coming into being and going out of being, just as the same way that the little plants come into being, have their lifespan, die, come back into being again, and so it is, cyclical. So it is with human beings. Why should it be any different? Why the assumption that the one thing in the whole universe that isn't cyclical is human beings? It's obvious to the whole Eastern Asian world and South Asian world, just as obvious that there is rebirth as it may be obvious to people in the Western world that there is not. That it starts here and ends here. And then whatever the promise is beyond, if you're holding to those promises, is that all great. But as far as life in this world is concerned, you got to make it or break it in one go-around. Either grab all the gusto you can get or prepare the way or something. That's it. It's just as obvious, I want to say, that this notion of reincarnation, just as obvious to them and as unprovable, although they think it, many of them think it's more provable, as our notion of one time you're born and then you die, and after this the judgment. The way of the cosmos, the way of humans. In that process now of being reborn over and over, there is a lot of suffering that goes on. Because the minute you are born, you experience limitation, and so the wailing, so the needs that have to be fulfilled, and as long as there's someone there to fulfill them, we can go on and have life. And then we deteriorate, and you know where we're headed from the time we're born. We're headed for death. And all the time between the birth and the death is marked by limitation. I can only be in one place at a time. I can't be watching my business in Indiana and at the same time be in Holden. I can't be with my loved one there and at the same time with my other loved one here. And I am so limited. Psychological powers, I don't have to tell you. Limitation. It's painful. It is painful. And so the cycle of birth and death is regarded as filled with pain. The experience of limitation. This one isn't working too well, is it?
No.
Samsara is the name it has. Samsara then refers to this world in which we experience our limitation and suffering. But through many births, they talk as though the Atman can be developed spiritually, can evolve spiritually to higher and higher stages of perfection until finally it can be released from this cycle of suffering. Die, never to die again. Come back to that in a minute, I think. I remember how I organized this one. Okay, as we are born over and over and over, there is a universal law that governs the process, and it's called law of karma. And you read that in all kinds of books, the karma. What is karma? Well, karma is sort of the moral or the residue of all our moral actions. Really means actions. And so whatever you do, it has consequence. Whether it's a thought, a thrust of emotion, an action, or whatever you do, inwardly, outwardly, it has its consequences. The inward things just as much or more so than the outward things. Think poisonous thoughts all the time, you're sick, and you make everybody else sick, and all of these things. So they say that there is a law of the universe that what you sow, that you will reap. And you will reap it now, in this life, across the busy intersection without checking the lights and zap. Or you will get the consequences of your behavior by by the way other people will respond to you, maybe, huh? But what they're saying that's different from the common sense thing that I've just been saying is that death does not stop the process of reaping what you have sown. Because until my dying moment, I am acting. I am performing actions. I have karma. New thoughts, new actions, new words, and always I die with a load of things that have not yet brought back to me their full consequences. So always we die with consequences left over. And the Atman seems to bear those away and therefore has to come back to birth again in order to work off those consequences of the last lifetime. But while I'm working those off, I'm producing new ones. And so the law of karma takes us round and round and round. And if our actions are mostly contrary to the truth of the universe, contrary to goodness, then our condition in our future birth will be worse and worse and worse and worse. So why are things so miserable in my life? Why was I born in a family where there was no inspiration, nothing beautiful, nothing but grubbiness and fighting each other for survival? Why was I born that way? Because of karma, past lifetimes. Those deeds that I have done in past lifetimes. So that counts. You don't have to blame God. It's just like the law of gravity. Nobody's mad at you because karma has sentenced this. It's just a natural law. All right, so that's what governs the process. But by good actions, by actions done according to the truth about this universe, which means, I guess, done according to God, let's say, and the will of God, and our life coming into harmony with that, and our actions flowing out of that harmony, then we come to higher and higher births. Sometimes those births, higher births, are thought of as being more pleasant. They are more pleasant, but mostly they are thought of as higher levels of development in our spiritual potential, because there is a perfection possible here. And when we come through many births to high enough levels of rebirth, we very well might be able to secure our release from rebirth and go beyond all karma, never to be born again. Thus, escaping from this world of the senses, this world of ignorance, this world of error, this world of karma. If we do that, let's see, what did I do? I'm already starting to drift right into this. The ultimate destiny, if we do that, is viewed several ways. One way of viewing it is that Brahman, can you see a B there? I'm sorry, my lighting situation, maybe I don't have things situated right. Brahman, that is the biggest word we can get to talk about the sacred without qualities. In Brahman is this world in his manifest form. But Brahman is beyond all things, unmanifest also. So the Atman, our soul, can escape from rebirth in this world and, like a drop of water, is joined to the universal ocean of being. We become permanently a part of the being of the One, not to come back into this sensory form again. That's one way to think about what it is. Of course, people worry about that because they want to know, is that going to really be me? Now, that's a very individualistic worry, isn't it? Will my personality that I have here and now, will that be sustained into that? Won't take that up at length right now, but most gurus would say, aha. The question shows how far you have to go, what you're clinging to, yourself. That self that you're really going to preserve from hell or high water. the monistic view, that is the view that the whole universe is one, and it is a divine universe, like a droplet, like a droplet returning to the ocean. And the way you attain that realization is through meditation, to realize your own divine self within, instead of focusing always on this ego self that has a name and a biography and all that stuff, and the one that you worry about all the time. Meditation helps us realize that oneness, and that transforms our attitudes, our wants, our everything. And that's how we come to be one with the sacred. And then when we pass from this world, we shall not be born again. That would be enlightenment. That would be awakening. Through that process of meditation, all earthly desires are quiet. And oneness is ultimate. Individuality is illusion. We come to realize all those things, that my individuality is really an illusion. My separateness from you is an illusion. We are one. And to realize that very deeply is to be a very transformed kind of person, with a whole different way of responding to everything in this world. And that's what Hinduism is about in its monistic view. But there's another branch of Hinduism that is sometimes called having a dualistic approach. The approach that says there is a kind of legitimate separateness between yourself and myself, between the self of the deity and the self of the deity worshiper. So that the deity worshiper isn't one with the deity, but is loved by the deity and loves the deity. That's relationship language again. Personal. The deity is personal. I am personal. The relationship between us is we come to each other in relationship rather than the other one, which is I am that identity. I am the divine. Here I realize a loving relationship rather than identity. That's the dualistic view that lets the God be something other than myself, and myself something other than the God. However, faithful to Hinduism, that dualistic view is wrapped up in a larger view that says, and yet beyond that separateness is a kind of oneness. That gets too philosophical to pursue. Just want you to know there aren't only them, the meditators, who only go for realization, I am the divine, and I am the universe, we are one. But there is also the temple goer who worships the deity and seeks this relationship and gift from the deity. In fact, in the pursuit of this human salvation, Hinduism has come to offer us three very major tracks that you can take. The path of knowledge through meditation, knowing the oneness of all things, knowing your true self as the divine self, knowing your true self is Atman, not Ed Seni from so-and-so who did this, had that feeling, that worry. For that is all a temporal passing thing like everything else in this world. But the true self is my Atman, my eternal Atman within. And that is one with. And that cannot be killed. And that cannot be destroyed, and that cannot respond to insult. Nothing can hurt it. To know your true self as that divine self is to be invulnerable. Death can't hurt that, because all it goes on. It is eternal. So that's the path of knowledge, and there you get all the gurus who teach us meditation, who teach us how to experience that oneness. And it's a long track, and there are many stages in it, and there are many aspects of it, and obviously I'm oversimplifying it terribly. B, the path of action and selfless service. That's where most people live, isn't it? They gotta act in this world. They can't sit in contemplation, because they gotta plant the wheat. And they gotta harvest it, and they gotta do the suffering. So what they can't be contemplative mystics all the time, at least, and maybe none of the time. And besides that, they're just not psychologically appropriate to that. to this self-analysis and all that stuff that goes into meditation. And that the reason they're not at that stage, the masses of people, is because of karma. To be ready for the kind of contemplative life that is the path of knowledge and meditation already shows that the Atman has undergone spiritual cultivation for eons, probably, and thus it is ready for a very high kind of experience. But most of us are at the level of action. We can say, I will do everything to the glory of God. So help me, God. I will do everything to the glory of God. Act in this world. I will serve my neighbor without, as much as possible, without concern for the self. Selfless service. And this is the building of good karma, which brings us toward higher births, and which is actually the inner cultivation of a higher spiritual potential. It's not just scoring points, you see. It's changing. It's transformation. But it's seen as transformation through many lifetimes rather than only in one lifetime. And then there is, of course, everybody has to worry about the life of action. Right action is where all the moral laws, everything that governs how you live rightly as a Hindu, is at stake here. Now these folks, a few of these folks who go the meditative path, kind of are beyond that. Many of these things, rules of life, they don't even have to worry about. They're kind of above it. It helps people who are at a lower stage, but it's no longer useful to them, so they don't bother. Third path, the path of devotion. That's simply devoting yourself to a deity, one deity or another, and thus, through that one deity, fastening yourself to the one universal divine reality. For each deity is but one more manifestation of the whole. And we, in our finitude, cannot grasp the greatness and the beauty and the fullness of God. But Hinduism says, God, in his perfect, in his perfection and completeness, is like a huge diamond with millions of facets. And no one can grasp the beauty of the whole, but we can grasp the whole only by fastening ourselves to one of those facets of the diamond. And so each deity is like a facet of the diamond, regardless of which one you attach yourself to in devotion, it can at least potentially be a way for you to be in communion with the One. So the path, this takes you to all the temple life of devotion, all the image worship throughout the homes and the villages of India. So action and devotion belongs to most people in India. Meditation to a relatively few. Always it has been a little on the esoteric side for it. But there are those three paths. Now that's big enough to embrace us all. And so Hinduism says, sure, Jesus is another special manifestation of that oneness. And Christianity is a path of devotion. It's one of the devotional paths to God. And that's fine. Hinduism will embrace us all. Now, that's all I've got time to say. I've got to give you a little bit of time to respond to that. But that, if you were able to go the next step, to look at what the Hare Krishna people are in this country, you will find that the Hare Krishna people are a legitimate manifestation of one of the devotional paths where Krishna is regarded as the supreme personality of Godhead. And all the Krishna thing that you've seen in this country is devoting everything to Krishna, a devotional path. Then many of you have heard of transcendental meditation. That clearly belongs in this. It is the notion of the oneness is behind it, the meditation as a way of realizing your full potential, anchoring yourself, finding your true identity in the oneness of the universe. So you can go from this kind of general introduction to have some handles and some hooks for understanding something like Hare Krishna's movement, or the Hare Krishna movement, or transcendental meditation. For those of you with special interest in that, I probably have a half a dozen little handouts that on one side have an outline of a lecture on Hare Krishna, and on the other side a lecture on TM, if that would be of any special interest while I have them, people could have them. Your questions? I wouldn't have the slightest idea. I was just, it's only because I saw the figures yesterday afternoon that I remembered the other one. I'm not good at remembering those kinds. But Hinduism, 85% of India, at least, is in some sense Hindu. And then beyond that, you have a few, percentage-wise, a very few Christians and a very few Muslims. Well, a little more on the Muslim side. And then you've got the Sikhs and the Jains and a few others, which in some larger way share, many of them at least, share much of the worldview that I've just described. But it's Hinduism is India for the most part.
Have you ever been to any funeral of any of these faiths?
No. I haven't been to one. I've read things about them, of course. But, there's the ceremony of on the funeral pyre, in the process of the cremation, the eldest son has certain obligations to say certain prayers, to tap the father's skull at a certain point so that from that soft spot, whatever it's called, the Atman can emerge to join the father's for a while.
Well, now the Baha'is don't believe in cremation, do they?
No, only returning. Baha'i is pretty much like Islam. I think Islam would take a fairly strong stand against cremation too, but I'm not going to be dogmatic about that. Maybe in India they wouldn't.
Do you know what their arguments are?
I don't think I do. I've felt like I understood them because it's kind of this returning to the dust from which we came. It's been sort of what we've inherited, that attitude toward it, and let the dust that brought us forth be the dust that receives us. And that's tied to an old Mother Earth kind of thing. The mother that gave us life, let her receive us back into her womb once again. I mean, all those sentiments, I think, are behind it. But, yeah, that's all I can do on that one.
Thank you.
I don't know, it's kind of overwhelming. You know, every time I study or read about other religions or have a little bit of explanation from someone like you that's well informed, I always end up just automatically finding similarities between religion and Christianity. I mean, there's also differences here, obviously.
Uh-huh.
But for me, it seems like it's just another manifestation of the way God has inspired other people, and yet sometimes it's a little confusing, some of the similarities and the blend of Eastern and Western, and I know even as I've read more mystical Christians and young writers, they have much more influence from it. It's even their own Christian approach. You know, it's real. Sometimes it's kind of like it becomes such a gray area of trying to understand both the similarities as well as the differences. And how different are they, and yet how similar are they?
Uh-huh.
You see what I'm saying? I don't have a question. I just have a comment.
That's right. It's an important comment. The comment is, as I hear it, is simply that there seems to be so much that we can resonate to. What? Why? That's kind of what I want to deal with more fully tomorrow, without any ribbons to wrap on that package. But to suggest it is one world. Christians believe there is one God, and I guess in some way or another Hinduism does too, and maybe it shouldn't be so surprising then that our ways of experiencing what that one God is in the world might have similarities, but they will also have differences, and I don't want to belittle those differences at all. They're very important, the differences are. I don't like to jump over those things, but first comes seeing that similarity, I think, by trying to understand these. I don't know anything else needs to be said about that. Yes, ma'am.
Do the Hindus have a Bible or a Quran?
They have many sacred texts. There is a whole collection of sacred texts called the Vedas. V-E-D-A. I don't need to write it, do I? V-E-D-A. Veda. And the Vedas include a whole bunch of different sections, a collection of hymns, like 1,000 and some hymns, that are like the Psalms, a kind of book of Psalms that were used in sacrificial worship. Then there are more philosophical documents like the Upanishads, that's part of Vedas. And then there are all kinds of other traditional books. Probably the most well-known one in this country would be the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God, which is not really technically one of the orthodox authoritative texts, and yet it has more influence in Hinduism than probably any other single text. Yes, they have many. And those texts, they say, are not revealed by the voice of a message-giving God, but those texts come from the wise men who, through meditation, have been able to see the truth about existence. Seers see into the ultimate truth of what this world is, what our life is, and what it all means. And so they have, through their meditation, come to those moments of enlightenment which they have then in some way or another expressed in such texts. So it's revelation not as a voice from heaven, but revelation as the truth revealing itself to those who were prepared to catch it for us and to help us see it. Okay? I'm going to take yours and then...
The early Christians, I came in the late time, but the early Christians believed in the incarnation of Jesus. And I'm wondering if that came from the Eastern, well, because Christianity had an Eastern origin, and
No, I don't think that is involved in Arianism. We need a different kind of historical theologian here to make sure about these things. But I do not accept the statement that early Christians, in some sort of general way, were reincarnationists. That was one view that popped out with its roots in Greek philosophy, certain forms of Greek philosophy, I think, which was, I believe, fed from the fountains of Hinduism, as you press it far enough back. But I do not accept that Christianity, sort of in general, took this view of reincarnation, but rather talking mostly about resurrection and sometimes talking as though there were a soul that was in a heavenly sphere or someplace until resurrection, but things like that. But there was some talk of it, yes. Now, did I respond to the essence of your question, or did I just pick up one piece of it?
Yeah, well, I'm just wondering if it just had an Eastern origin, if there was such a thing as early Christians believing in
Christianity. But then I think I have responded to as well as I know how right now, anyway. Yeah.
Is there any historical connection between Christian Science in this country and Hinduism? There are so many similarities.
There is. But I don't know what they are well enough off the cuff to say what they are. But I think there definitely are. I mean, the Christian Science was informed by this worldview of India. And it's my obligation, no matter how interesting your questions are, to end this session so that you can do what needs to be done. And I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.